This is Morning Edition on Vermont Public Radio. I'm Mitch Wertlieb. Good morning. He was the last player to bat over 400, a record that stood since 1941. He hit 521 home runs in his career, and who knows how many more he would have had if he hadn't lost five of his prime playing years to military service in World War II and the Korean War. He homered in his final at-bat after a career that spanned more than two decades, but refused to tip his cap to the fans who were there to cheer the feat. He was, and I am more than happy to say it plainly without fear of reprisal, the greatest hitter who ever lived. He was Ted Williams, and his mythical status as a ballplayer was actually equaled by a life beyond the game that was marked by rancor, charity, bombast, and regret. The story of Ted Williams on and off the field is told in a huge book befitting its subject called The Kid, The Immortal Life of Ted Williams. It's written by Ben Bradley Jr., former editor and reporter for the Boston Globe, who joins us now on the line. And Ben Bradley Jr., thanks so much for speaking with us.
Morning, Mitch. How are you?
Doing well, thank you. And, you know, much of your book is focused on Ted Williams' private life, which was unsettled, to say the least. Why do you think he was so ill at peace with his personal relationships?
Well, I think it's because of the anger that he struggled with all his life. I think the source of the anger was rooted in his troubled relationship with his mother. He grew up in San Diego during the Depression, and his mother worked for the Salvation Army, saving souls. And this was what was most important to her in life, to the exclusion of all else, including the relationship with her son Ted and Ted's brother Danny. Williams' father, her husband, was an alcoholic and largely absent and really not a figure in Ted's life growing up. And the anger became a double-edged sword. It helped him on the field because he always said that he hit better mad and go off on a tear and hit 500 for a month. But in his personal relationships, this anger would bubble up at inappropriate times and places and caused him great difficulty with his three wives. He had three brief marriages and his three children.
Well, he was certainly driven, and you know, as I said at the top there, beyond baseball, he really was kind of this John Wayne figure, like John Wayne portrayed on the screen, that is. I mean, he volunteered for military service, and as you write in the book, he came pretty close to dying in combat. What happened on his first combat flight in Korea?
Well, that was an amazing story. You know, he should have died. He flew 39 combat missions in Korea. He didn't see combat in World War II. They held him back as an instructor. But in Korea, he was the wingman for John Glenn. And I interviewed Glenn, and Glenn told me he thought Williams was one of the best pilots he'd ever seen. High praise from the astronaut. But on this mission where he really should have died, he was shot and strafed with gunfire. He lost his radio contact, lost the hydraulics. The landing gear wouldn't come down, and the plane was on fire. And if he'd been following the Marine Corps protocol, he would have ejected. But he was so tall at 6'4", had to be shoehorned into the cockpit as it was, and he worried that if he ejected, he would cap his knees and not be able to play baseball again. So he resolved to bring it in on its belly, the plane, and on fire, and skidded for about a mile and hopped out without a scratch on him.
He did so many great things on the field, and he was mostly surrounded by pretty bad teams with the Red Sox, with the exception of maybe the late 40s, 46,
right,
and 48. You mentioned about his contentious relationship with the sports writers, and he mockingly referred to them as the Knights of the Keyboards.
Yes.
Were the writers unfair to him?
No, I don't think they were, bottom line. He was very naive about the press. He wanted fame, but not the inconvenience of celebrity. Couldn't appreciate that he was a public figure, a hero to many, and that the public had a legitimate interest in wanting to know something about his life off the field, who he was, what made him tick. And so if a reporter pursued a story like that and called his mother, say, for the most innocuous quote for a puff piece, he would go crazy, Williams, and confront the writer and say, you have no right to write about my private life, period. Remember one of his teammates, Don Budden, the shortstop of the 50s, told me a funny story. He said, after one of these rants, he said to Ted, Ted, how can you treat the writers this way? They have a job to do. Ted said, son, you hit 350, you can do a lot of things.
You know, the other side of that gruff coin, though, of the irascible side of Ted was you know, folks today, especially Red Sox fans, are well acquainted with the Jimmy Fund for cancer research.
Yes.
Was Ted Williams really the man who made that possible?
Oh, he was. It was the example of his kindness and his fundamental decency. And I think it's the redemptive part of the Ted Williams story. This is a warts and all treatment, and there's a lot of shocking stuff in the book about how cruel he could be to the loved ones and to friends. But he would go to the doctors and the nurses and give them his phone number and say, if you think that a visit from me any time of the day or night will help these kids, who virtually all died back in those days, then I will come. And he did, because this was genuine. And he did it, and not only did he do that, he raised millions of dollars for the Jimmy Fund over the years.
And there was also, you write about his induction to the Hall of Fame in 1966, and I think he surprised a lot of people by focusing in his speech on the unfair treatment of black players over the years and the lack of a black manager in baseball. Where did that concern for minority athletes come from?
Yeah, well, that's an important question, good question, and particularly ironic, because Ted was Mexican-American, his mother was Mexican, and he concealed the fact that he was Mexican-American his entire life, worried that prejudice of the day would hurt his baseball career. Yet, in 1966, when he was being inducted into the Hall of Fame, he did this pointed digression from thanking everyone who was responsible for his career into calling on the Lords of Cooperstown to right a fundamental wrong, which was that they had excluded the old Negro League players from consideration in the Hall of Fame merely because they were black. And so we called on them to drop their color line and admit the likes of Satchel Paige and Josh Gibson. This was a bold political statement. Ball players never talk like that. And Bowie Kuhn, who was the commissioner at the time and respected Williams enormously, adopted the recommendation that earned Williams enormous goodwill with the black players who loved him because of that.
One of the things you write about early in the book is actually about the end of Ted Williams' life, and it's such a grotesque thing. His son, John Henry, when Ted Williams died, decided to have his head removed from his body, cryogenically frozen in the hopes that future technology might one day revive him somehow. I want to know if you were personally saddened about having to write about such an ignominious fate for such a proud and larger-than-life figure as Ted Williams.
Yeah. Well, it was a sad ending for the greatest hitter who ever lived, no question. I concluded that it had to be dealt with. When I interviewed the old-timers, especially people like Johnny Pesky and Dominic DiMaggio, who are both now gone, they were particularly offended by the cryonics, and they urged me not to write about it, because after all, you were dealing with two or three generations of people who weren't old enough to remember Ted Williams, the ball player, but were hearing about him for the first time in the context of this ghastly cryonics affair. John Henry himself died suddenly, his son, in 2004 of leukemia. And to his credit, since he was the one who foisted cryonics upon his father, he himself had his remains frozen. So father and son are together at this facility in Arizona called Alcor. There's only one Williams child now living. And Claudia, the youngest, told me the story for the book, what happened. And she says he agreed. But my conclusion was that if he did, he was not of sound mind. And I was able also to track down about a dozen people whom he told that no, he wanted to be cremated and have his ashes thrown off the keys where he had lived and fished for many years, and as his will specified. But I conclude in the book that people know this was some sort of family deal, and I think people are prepared to cut Ted Williams a lot of slack and not blame him in any way for this cryonics business, or think that he went crazy at the end. And I think with the passage of time, people will always remember Ted Williams as the last player to hit 400, you know, forever the kid.
Ben Bradley Jr. is the author of The Kid, The Immortal Life of Ted Williams, and he'll be reading from the book at Bear Pond Books in Montpelier Tuesday night. Thank you so much for taking the time to talk with us.
Thank you. I enjoyed it, Mitch.